Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On last week we got lost at the multiplex, but today we celebrate our Independence Day as we return to our local art house cinemas, Filmhouse and the Belmont Filmhouse. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always it's Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Much better this week. I think anyone that's listened the past few weeks, I've not been the most positive about some of the films that we've watched, and it's all been building towards what we're going to be talking about this week. So hopefully this smile on my face is translating in audio form. So yeah, I'm happy.
Good. And I guess, you know, we're going to be talking about those two particular film houses, but I did see that at the weekend, you know, Glasgow was lucky enough to drop down to level 2, which means that the Glasgow Film Theatre has been able to reopen. Are you going to be making a trip across on the train to Glasgow at some point and checking out what they've got to offer?
Not yet. Like, I'm quite lucky that they seem to be showing a lot of the same films that we're lucky enough to get through here in Edinburgh. I know they've got After Love on at the moment, a film I'm really keen to see, but I know Filmhouse have announced that they're going to be showing that one in a few weeks' time. So anything that I was kind of needing to go see in Glasgow has now been sort of given to me here in Edinburgh, which is really good. But I'm hopeful of making a trip through to Glasgow in a couple of weeks. It blows my mind, the last time I was in Glasgow was early October, and I had grand plans of, like, I'm going to go walk around some lovely parks there, have a wee change of scenery. Unfortunately, I arrived in Glasgow and it started pissing down with rain. So I went for a Pisano pizza, and I had like a ticket booked for the evening for seeing St. Maud again at the Everyman Cinema. So I had that, and I was like, oh my God, this grand plan of seeing different sites, different parks, different green spaces in Glasgow. What am I going to do after my Pisano? And I went to see After We Collided instead. So yeah, it's been a long time since I've been to Glasgow to do anything good or anything cultural, so I will have to rectify that at some point.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I would love to get down to Glasgow just for the Pisano, really. Last time I was there was actually the 2020 Glasgow Film Festival, just before the whole world went to hell. And yeah, I've been missing my Pisanos and my Tim Hortons, so yeah, at some point now that they've rejoined the rest of us, although I'm technically down in level 1. You're still on level 2, but you know, I'm completely confused as to what the differences are between the levels at this point. You know, as long as I can get to this, it's about the number of people who can meet up in a park or something like that.
No, it's that pretty much soft play things can open up place like so yeah, unfortunately
that major industry in Scotland, which apparently I didn't realize was a thing until you see all the people on the news complaining that their soft play center cannot open.
It's truly crazy. I will be up in Aberdeen in a couple of days time, but fortunately I won't be able to fit in any trips to the cinema this time, or unfortunately soft play.
Yeah, because I think we do have one or two, but you know, I've got a few friends who are parents, and yes, I think they're looking forward to that. But as long as cinemas remain open, that's all I care about. But before, you know, we head back to the big screen, you know, we both wanted to independently sort of talk about a film that's coming to the small screen this weekend. You sort of texted me today just as we're deciding what to feature, and I was about to mention the same thing just before you did. So screening on Mubi from this Friday, 11th of June, is Shiva Baby, not Shiva Baby, because I've got a cat called Shiva, so I was calling it Shiva Baby, but no, it's pronounced Shiva. Shiva Baby, written and directed by Emma Seligman, and it was a breakout hit at last year's Toronto Film Festival. It stars Rachel Sennott as Danielle, a young Jewish woman who runs into her sugar daddy at a Jewish funeral service that is being attended by her family, and including her parents as well. Cue a very, very awkward 77 minutes. So Lee, you said we need to talk about this film on the podcast. What was it about it that, you know, has got you raving? You know, did you know much about it before sort of going in?
No, there'd been a bit of hype about the film, but I didn't really know the plot. I didn't know that its origins are sort of a short movie. I think the short's only about 8 minutes long, but I kind of just had heard a little bit about sort of this movie about this quirky Jewish woman and sort of like, oh, everything goes wrong. And I was sitting there thinking, That sounds like the type of thing I really, really like. So I kind of got the screener a couple of weeks ago and I just kept forgetting that I had it. And I think it was like Saturday evening. I was slightly sunburned. I'd been out in the sun all day and I was like just ready to just lie down. I was like, you know what? I'm going to finally watch it. And it was just really perfect for me. It was just, I love movies about quirky people, mumblecore. Like, this should not be a surprise to anyone. And I just watched it and I thought, it's the type of thing similar to, you know, Eighth Grade a couple of years ago, where it's like social anxiety is turned basically into a horror movie with like the use of music and camera and creative decisions. I just thought it was fantastic. I was not familiar with, I knew Molly Gordon, obviously, from things like Booksmart and the Broken Hearts Gallery. But yeah, the lead actress, Rachel Sennanot, I think she's going to be a hell of a breakout from this movie. It was just really good. I love condensed stories, and this one just taking place at a shiva, which is, you know, a kind of Jewish wake, and it was just, everything was just amped up. It was uncomfortable to watch. It was stressful. I was like, yep, this is perfect. And everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and people are making terrible decisions as you, as an audience member, you're just sitting there like wincing behind your kind of hands. I'm hopeful this one will get a bit of a cinema release. I think probably the moment's gone. I know it's going to be on Mubi from Friday. I know Mubi have released some films into the cinema and we'll have some coming out, but I think with the way this one's just landed, I think this one's just going straight to there. But I would have loved to experience this one as uncomfortably as possible within a cinema.
Yeah, no, I think I know, because Mubi had released First Cow a couple of weeks ago in cinemas, and then I think it goes on to Mubi on the 6th of July. So I think the fact that it's debuting straight to Mubi means that it won't get a full cinema release, but I can certainly see like this getting like a few screenings, maybe somewhere like the Prince Charles or something. I know that London do a Jewish film festival, so I mean, it's just perfect for that. I think it maybe even sort of played the Jewish film festival last year, maybe. So, but I mean, I'm sure they could play it again. But yeah, no, I mean, I think this is, I mean, what I really loved about this film is essentially it, you know, it's very short, you know, it's only 77 minutes, so just over an hour. But essentially the movie, apart from like the one scene at the beginning, basically it plays out in real time. So you're with this character as this whole thing unfolds. The way you were talking about it made it sound as stressful as sort of Uncut Gems, another sort of Jewish thriller in a way. And, you know, I didn't know much about it, so going in, either I knew that it had Fred Melamed from A Serious Man and other fantastic films. But yeah, no, the way that, I mean, if you look at the plot where, you know, this young girl meets her sugar daddy at a funeral, and, you know, there's sort of lies, duplicity, there's, you know, awkward encounters and stuff like that, it could have been played like a straight sort of farce. And whenever I think of farce, I always think of, I think it's one of your favourite TV episodes. It's certainly one of mine. It's the Frasier episode in the ski lodge where people, there's so many sort of miscommunications about who fancies who and stuff like that, and everyone's coming outdoors and doing all that. That kind of, it could have been played that sort of way. However, the director and writer of it, Emma Selman, who apparently has drawn on episodes of from her real life and whatever, the way it's designed, especially with the soundtrack, the sort of discordant strings and stuff like that, like you say, the sort of social anxiety sort of level, it does sort of play out at times. It feels like a existential horror film, not an elevated horror or anything, but like an existential horror, where the music choice and the camera choice, whatever, makes it seem like, well, I mean, essentially, you know, the character of Danielle is trapped in her own personal nightmare for 70 minutes, to which there is no escape, especially when it turns out that the sugar daddy is not only married, but it's also got a newborn child as well. And of course they turn up at the wake, and of course more awkward things happen and stuff like that. But I mean, it is a true sort of breakout performance from Rachel Sennett. I'd never heard of her before, but I think we're going to be hearing big things from her in the future, do you think?
Yeah, I think so too. Like, it's just one of these ones. It reminds me almost of probably the similar reaction I had to well, I knew of her at the time and had seen her in a few things, but someone like Greta Gerwig and Frances Ha, and I can see this being a film that will have some really great word of mouth. Like, I think a lot of people will see themselves in this, whether they're a young woman, whether they're someone that's a bit older that's a bit anxious, someone that just enjoys good comedy and drama. I can see this being one that you'd really recommend. I know, for example, that when I watched it, I was thinking, I've got to message this person about this film. Like, they've got to watch this one, and this person, and this person. It's one of those films that you kind of, it's a shame it's on something like Mubi, where the audience for those screeners are a bit more limited. It's not something that the mainstream necessarily have. It's not something where you can recommend to friends and go, get on Prime or Netflix. So you kind of have to hope that a friend has this or is willing to pay the subscription or take out a bit of a free trial to watch kind of the film, which can be a bit frustrating. But I think something like this, you just want to shout about it from the rooftops, and I think this film will find an audience for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it is almost somewhat of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Maybe, you know, they do pick up some fantastic films. You know, they did one of our favorite films a couple of years ago, Under the Silver Lake, but again, sometimes the cinema rollout is limited to none. So therefore it can be sort of difficult for people to find these films on sort of initial release. It really is sort of a huge sort of word of mouth thing, but I think people will be certainly talking about this. The reviews are starting to sort of pop up in the trades, sort of like Empire and Guardian and stuff like that. So it has got a lot of love from the critics here. So we just have to hope that it finds a similar audience. And interesting to see what Emma Seligman does next, but Rachel Sennott, I've just checked my old IMDb, and you'll be glad to know that she's joining the A24 family. She will be in the upcoming Bodies, 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 the A24 slasher movie, which they want to be their generation Scream. So yes, big things are clearly on the way for Rachel Sennott, and let's find out what Emma Seligman is doing, if nothing else. I'm sure she will be doing something. But upcoming project, something called Sugar. A TV series called Sugar. No idea what it's about. But I'm sure we won't have seen or heard of the last of her. So yes, unfortunately, it's unavailable to see at your local multiplex or indeed art house cinema. But the art house cinemas reopened up in Scotland this past week. Filmhouse and Belmont both reopened on Monday the 31st, just a couple of weeks after everyone else. Get to be a little bit more picky and choosy about what they show, so no Godzilla versus Kongs or anything like that. But Lee, you went back I think opening day. What were you there to see, and was it good to be back?
Yeah, it was good. I went three times last week, so I basically chucked my money at the film house, and even I've had some wine at the film house, I've had some chicken shawarma. It's been, it's been good. It was one of those ones. I think the film that I was most excited to see at the film house was Sound of Metal, but that wasn't out till the Friday. But yeah, I was so enthusiastic about seeing First Cow originally. Like, I decided, I was like, I'm going to see First Cow, Sound of Metal, and Minari in my first week back at the film house, and in my enthusiasm to book the tickets, I realized I booked First Cow twice, once for the Monday and once for the Wednesday, which involved an embarrassing email to their admin team of like, being really sorry, could you cancel First Cow and put me into Minari like half an hour later on the Wednesday, which was they were really good at doing. But yeah, First Cow was the first one up, and this was one that, it was the one I was at least excited to see at the film house, because I'd probably seen this one, I think I'd seen it three times by now. And that's no detriment to the film. It was just the one I'd seen the most. Kind of, I've had it for like nearly a year now on digital. I've watched it, then I watched it again for the podcast, and then I watched it with one of my mates one night. So yeah, this one was the one I'd kind of dived into to the most. But yeah, it was lovely to go into the cinema at the film house again and see this one. It was just, it was so beautiful to see Oregon brought to life like that. I've seen a couple of Kelly Reichardt films at the film house over the years, and it's one of those films I thought it worked really well being able to finally see this one on the big screen, because there's so much of it can be shot at night and it can be a bit dark. As much as your home setup can be good, as soon as you can have all your lighting settings all done correctly, sometimes these things can get a little washed out on the TV. But to see it kind of projected onto the big screen, just a couple rows in front of you, everything feels a bit more richer. And I think First Cow is just a beautiful film. You know, the three films I picked as the to see this week. Two of them were in my top three films of last year, which was a real treat to finally turn them into big screen experiences. And for those that haven't kind of seen First Cow, I know it's also on at the GFT, the Belmont and the Film House. It's a film just basically about sort of, you know, set in the early 1800s, and, you know, a kind of fur trapper and a cook kind of milk a cow and make donuts. Like, that is like as simple as that. But what kind of people, what we kind of learn about sort of kind of corporation, not corporations, but sort of like the, you know, the industrial complex as it kind of begins to come to America, and just like these people just want to make donuts and they're just taking some milk, and kind of the bigger questions about society and how people treat them, you know, is tough. And it's impossible not to watch this and think of it as like a love story between two men. Are they gay? Maybe, who knows, you know, time might tell. But, you know, it was such a beautiful film to see in the cinema. And I was so glad that we've got the opportunity here in the UK to see it. You know, I know it kind of had a bit of a rollout in America just before COVID kicked in, so it's had a really limited run here, but cinemas up and down the country are showing it, and I would encourage people to go along and support a film like this. It's definitely one of A24's best films in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I mean, I might be able to catch it over the next week or so, but, you know, I mean, I really liked it when I first saw it, and yeah, I think it'd be good to see it on the big screen. I was disappointed with the marketing of the film, just purely from the poster choice, which has First Cow in big yellow letters, but it features the two men. It's like, that poster needs more cow. Yeah, there needed to be more cow in the marketing. But other than that, I think it's a great film. But disappointing that the film has weren't going in on the tie-in with these oily cakes for sale in the foyer.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those things, if they don't do popcorn, do they do donuts? That's the big question. But yeah, I just think, yeah, you watch a film like this and it is just like that cinema. Like, you just watch it like... I mean, not that I had any real problems with the first few weeks of films that kind of came out, but like they were entertaining films, or they were movies. But it's like, I always kind of, I suppose after kind of a year in lockdown, and even kind of the films that came out last year, they were by and large, you know, your Tenants and such, like, they weren't films where you were like, I'm going on the human experience and, you know, journey. And I think of like, it came out last week, the new Wolf Alice album, which is excellent. And like, I think its main song is kind of The Last Man on Earth. And it's like, it's all about like people watching and reading and listening to art and trying to see themselves in it, rightly or wrongly. And you just watch these kind of couple of films and it's impossible not to relate to turn of this 18th century fur trappers and donut makers and like see yourself reflected in it. And the same with some of the other films. And that's what I like to go to the cinema to see, is like myself reflected back, or see my feelings and thoughts or worries kind of shared, and kind of be able to just switch off in the dark and go, they get it and I feel seen. And I certainly felt that way with something like First Cow, where it was just like, you just kind of, we've had to make do with a bit of a simpler life, but there's always just that something out there that's looking to maybe get to you or challenge you just now. Obviously that's COVID. But yeah, there was just something simple about, you know, two people just trying to survive and get along and make the best of a really tough situation.
Yeah, no, it's about finding the simple pleasures in life. I think it's that moment where sort of Toby Jones eats the oily cake for the first time. He's like, this taste of London in this cake, or is it taste of home or something like that, where something small or whatever can just, you know, bring you back. And that's what I guess we've all had to hang on to over the last year, the promise that, you know, we will be able to return to these small things which make us feel a little bit better. And I know that the cinemas had that for me. I've sort of often said, I think I said it last week, about this mindfulness. I can find mindfulness at the movies where I'm able to switch off and just watch a film, no other distractions. Whereas at home, you know, it's, I'm keen to sort of, yeah, like you say, hear your experience of rewatching these films where you've watched them at home, where there's maybe the, you know, the tendency to sort of pause the film, go get a drink or get something to eat, or, you know, check your phone or something, text or something during the film or whatever, where you're just watching the film. You know, was it anything new that you were sort of picking up on or able to enjoy more without the sort of distractions of the home sort of home cinema setting?
I think more with Minari, because I'd only seen it once, and probably the same with Sound of Metal. Whereas First Cow, I suppose those other two films, Sound of Metal, Minari, I watched on my laptop because like the screeners didn't screen to my Apple TV, like they were banned. I just had to make do with them on the smallest of screen. Whereas First Cow, at least I could watch on a 42-inch TV. I could watch it in sort of like high definition. I could watch it through a sound system. Like I'd picked up on these sorts of things. I think the one thing I really took away from First Cow was that was slightly different was seeing it kind of the way it was meant to, kind of, you know, a film in that kind of aspect ratio. Yeah, it kind of looks good on the TV, but on the bigger screen, you get a lot more detail. But I think for me, I really picked up on it this time where it was a lot of the background extras and the characters at the camps and at the little base that they had. These people just felt all the more richer for being able to focus on them a little bit. And, you know, I mentioned at the time, like René Auberjonois, he's been in a couple of Kelly Reichardt films. This was one of his last films. He was someone I was lucky enough to meet a couple of times at things like Star Trek conventions. He's just an incredible character actor with the most stunning of faces. And just, I'd forgot that he popped up a couple of times in the film. I remember the first time he appears on the screen, but just seeing his face every time, I was like, yeah, no, this was a man that we lost sort of just before lockdown to cancer. And just to see his face there on the big screen one last time felt like a really good tribute. And just seeing all these other different background characters and actors, you know, I thought it brought the film to life. So I was really happy to see First Cow and to return to the film house to see this film first.
Yeah, no, and you mentioned that you saw Minari there again. I mean, what did you make of the... this on the big screen with the now Oscar-winning turn from Yi Young-yun.
Oh, it was so good. Like, I really liked Minari. And it's the annoying thing is, like, I always think, like, it's almost impossible to love a film on a screener, on a laptop and so on. Like, I 100% believe it's possible for some people, but it's never... It always needs to be on the big screen to just take it over the line for me. And I really liked Minari last year. I thought it was excellent. I enjoyed my experience, but... geez, like seeing it on kind of the big screen, like every emotion seemed to be kind of amplified a lot more. Like the bit I kind of come back to, like there's a bit towards the end of the film where Jacob and Monica are like, they're having an argument outside this little shop, and you know, is their marriage worth saving, you know, can it be overcome? And there was a bit like I never noticed it, and it's whether it's testament to me being distracted or being on the smallest of laptop screens, where you see Steven Yeun's lip really shake. You know, it vibrates, it's like he's just emotional, he's trying to keep it in. And I just was like captivated by that moment where I was like, that's why we go to the cinema, that's why you watch films on the big screen. And just seeing that little tremble of his lip, I was like, I didn't notice that. And I felt, we've all been there where we've had like maybe a confrontation, we're upset, our relationship's ending, something like that. And we've all had that, the lips trembled, but we're like keeping it together, just keeping it together. And I never noticed that the first time around. And it was just like, yes, I got that moment where I was completely taken in by this family's drama. And it's, the big thing for me is when I watched Minari, I don't know about the same for you, but when I watched it last year on the laptop, I was like, great film, really good drama, some funny bits, like, yeah. But I didn't realize how funny the first half of that film was until I watched it with an audience. I mean, the film house screen was maybe 25% full, but people were all laughing along at some of the similar moments and shared that. And this is the first quote-unquote comedy stuff that I've seen in the past a couple of weeks. Like Spiral is not a comedy, The Unholy or whatever it was called, not a comedy. Yeah, just none of these things are comedies. And you're like, you forget what it's like to share something funny or like what plays with an audience. We're like, oh, I didn't laugh at that at home, but yeah, that is quite funny. And you just end up kind of chuckling along and so on. So yeah, that was really like, it was little moments like that where you were like, God, it was so good to see it on a big screen and with an audience. It deserved all the accolades. And God, I was really, you know, I was heartbroken for the grandmother Sunya. And just, she's just such a great character. She reminds me a lot of my grandmother that I'm still lucky that is alive and healthy. And yeah, it's just one of those things, like, it had the same reaction when I watched it first time, and more so this one, where you just want to just like hug a family member, you know, tell someone that you love them, look after them. And just, yeah, and I thought, like, I didn't click with it so much the first time, but again, in the big screen, the character of Paul, played by Will Payton, God, he is, you know, such a tragic and sad character. And yeah, some of him plays quite funny with a crowd, but when you watch that, you just go, what an actor. You know, he's someone that's been in so many, like, I think Michael Bay movies, was it, like, things like Armageddon, etc. But, like, he's never stood out as an actor for me. He's just someone. But you watch that, you think, Jesus, he was incredible as Paul, and how he threw himself into that role, and he just seemed like a completely alien and different character. So yeah, Minari was such a treat to see in the audience, and I think the first time I had a good cry in the cinema since God knows when. But for someone that enjoys crying in the cinema, it was good to get that back with Minari.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's something about the cinema experience where certain films, yeah, they're fine. You can watch them at home and you can appreciate them. I mean, Minari, me and myself, I thought it was a very good film. That was a solid film. I think if I did see it on the big screen, I probably would have a different sort of reaction to it. I probably would connect with it more. But like you say, when you're watching it on a phone or something, it is sometimes difficult to pick up on some of the smaller sort of minutiae and detail of the film. Like you say, it's the films, like, you know, comedies and horror films that when you experience them with an audience where everyone's sort of laughing together or jumping out their skin together and stuff like that, that's when you realize the power of cinema to connect so many people. And I think that's what's just fantastic. And that's what I want to get back to experiencing is as much as possible, you know. So whenever it is possible, I would like to see a film first on the big screen rather than the small screen. You know, there was very few films I sort of watched probably during lockdown that, you know, would have had a really sort of strong reaction. I mean, I think the only film that I maybe sort of gave sort of like 5 stars to was probably like Another Round. And I know that seeing that on the big screen, I think it's out at the end of June or sort of beginning of July, that film on the big screen, particularly the end scene, which unfortunately has done the rounds on Twitter ad nauseum at the moment, where everyone kind of knows what's coming at the end. But I think to experience it in context, I think will be a joyful moment to experience that in a packed cinema, or, well, as socially distanced capacity will allow, packed cinema. But, you know, one thing that we talked about last week, and now we talk about again, is the sort of accessibility and representation of the deaf community on screen. And we both managed to see on big screen for the first time, having already seen it previously, and that was Sound of Metal, which is directed by Darius Marder and stars Oscar nominated Riz Ahmed as Ruben, a heavy metal drummer who suddenly starts to lose his hearing and is faced with not only being unable to do the thing that he loves, but how to cope with that in the aspect of being a former addict. And he starts struggling, and so his girlfriend and sort of co-band member sets him up at this camp for sort of a community for deaf people, where they sort of deal with addicts and stuff like that. And it's about how he learns to integrate himself into that society. It was Oscar nominated, won for Best Sound. And I think you and I both said, I think at the end of last year, the one film that we'd seen in 2020 that we wanted to experience on the big screen was Sound of Metal, if nothing else, for the sound mix. So did it live up to its big screen potential?
Yeah, it went to a 5-star film for me. It was just, yeah, I went to see it on a Friday night. I actually went to see it with someone that has a hearing aid as well, which was really good. And, you know, that was something they'd also seen the film as well, and they wanted to go get that experience as well. And I just thought it was a fantastic film. I thought it was the best of the Oscar contenders last year. I still think it is. It's one of those things that avoids all the cliches that you kind of expect of a film like this. Like, you expect the drummer to hear, oh my God, he's going to lose his hearing, but he's going to kind of go on regardless playing drums. And you get that for like one bit where you go like, oh, it's going that route, but then it completely pulls back. And I just think the performance of Riz Ahmed, Olivia Cooke, who we've had on this show before, were fantastic. And it was just, I come away from that where I have an auntie that is completely deaf and speaks in sign language, and I've never known her much to ever have, you know, I see her maybe like once every few years and so on, and I'm not able to communicate with her. You know, for all my sins, I've never learned sign language. My dad does. I've got some of my closest friends and people I care about have hearing impairments or hearing loss, and it's one of those things, like, I work with people with disabilities and health conditions, and I can often be very empathetic and understanding, but you can never truly put yourself into someone's, you know, shoes, or in this case, I suppose, ears, where it's like, what is it like where you maybe have a hearing aid and you are in a loud room? Maybe it's the film festival, you've just watched Sound of Metal and everyone's talking and sharing ideas and talking over each other. What's that like? What's that like when you tune in for the first time with a hearing aid? Is it terrifying? Is it exciting? Is it liberating? All these things, like, you can ask someone, they can share their thoughts and experiences, but something like this, it really puts you in there. And I just felt really grateful for a film like this, where it was like, I come away understanding my friends and family just that little bit more, that little bit better. And, you know, as I try to be, you know, an ally and friend to the deaf community and all that sort of stuff, and to, you know, consider how I behave and act around people that have hearing loss and so on, and in terms of where do I place myself, how do I talk in certain ways, I can mumble at times, I try not to do that, for example, all these different things. It's like, it just makes me consider what I do maybe well, but what I should definitely be doing more of. And I think films like this, especially the fact that it's on Prime, it's a great film for people to have no excuses to watch something like this and to hopefully come away and have a bit more sympathy and understanding. And, you know, I think the main thing as well, and the film is equally is about putting yourself in other people's shoes. It's about getting to that place of peace and mindfulness. And I suppose we spoke about it there. You know, that is one of the key things that one of the characters in the film is talking about, where it's like, it's writing things down, having feelings, making peace with a really crap situation. And that's been our past 15 months going on, and probably for a little while longer, where we've all struggled and had like the worst time. But how many of us have found peace and mindfulness in a moment like this? How many, you know, have we tried to constantly outrun it, outgun it? Probably. I know I certainly have. Have I come out of it a better person for it? Have I made peace with it? Probably not. But when you watch that character that has gone through something all the more traumatic find that kind of moment, it makes me kind of think like, God, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have written down some of my thoughts. Maybe I should have, like, you know, made peace with some of the bad stuff, maybe kind of moved on from some stuff. I thought that was really impressive as well. I think there's so much to be taken from this, whether you're someone that's got hearing loss or don't. It's just a powerful, powerful film. I loved it.
Yeah, no, I think that's something which I sort of picked up on the second viewing, not the first time I watched it, but was the, you know, there's that lovely moment at the end, which I'm not going to spoil, but it relates to this sort of, like, the thing of sort of mindfulness and stillness, because, like, the character of that Paul Raki plays, who's Oscar nominated for Best Supporting Actor in here, a fantastic turn by him. He sort of talks to Ruben about, you know, he wants him to just sort of sit in a room and be with himself. You know, if he's getting agitated, but if he needs to write it down, but the aim is to get these moments of stillness. And, you know, it's something which, you know, Ruben is unable to do throughout the film. You know, essentially it feels like, you know, the loss of hearing he's experiencing is like, you know, a loss of, like, a person almost. It's taking away the one thing that he lost and that he loves, which was music. And he then kind of sort of goes through those sort of, was it the five stages of grief, of sort of, you know, anger, denial, sort of depression, acceptance, bargaining, and all these things. Bargaining becomes for acceptance always has to be the last one, and he sort of finally sort of does at the end. But, you know, he goes through these various stages through the film, and, you know, it's just the way that, you know, the film puts you, like you say, in his shoes. So, you know, when you're in his mindset, you know, then the hearing is either sort of distorted, or, you know, silenced, muffled and stuff like that. And, you know, the sound really sort of puts you in there. I mean, it reminded me of, there was one scene from a film, I think it's Babel, many, many years ago, where I think it was Rinko Kikuchi was a deaf Japanese girl. And there's one scene where she goes into a nightclub and it's completely silent. You experience it from her perspective, where it's just completely silent. It was an incredible scene. And we saw it sort of last week with Quiet Place 2, where it goes to scenes where it's from the character of Millicent Simmons' perspective. So where at that point it's completely silent, and it's used for dramatic effect to sort of show the monster sort of coming up on her. But this one really sort of puts you in the shoes of what it is like to be experiencing this healing loss. And not only does it put you in a situation or a disadvantage of being unable to control that. But what I found interesting is Sound of Metal, the Vertigo releasing, have done this thing where every screening, I'm assuming it was the same that the film was here, is fully captioned. So you get not only the dialogue is subtitled, but also you get the little bits in caption bars where it sort of says what's going on in terms of sounds and stuff like that. But at the beginning, when he first goes to the camp, the sign language is not subtitled because Ruben doesn't understand it. So therefore, we're put in his position. Not only is he losing his hearing, but he's then thrown into the scenario where it's a completely alien world to him. He can't, you know, contribute, or he can't, you know, communicate with people because he doesn't know sign language. It's something he has to learn. So as he advances in his time at the camp, you know, eventually we do sort of pick up, he does learn sign language and stuff, and then you do get a bit more of the subtitles with that. So then we sort of go on this journey with him, and I think it was just a really sort of fascinating take on the film. And you know, it's just, yeah, superbly acted by Riz Ahmed, really sort of deserved the Oscar nomination. Olivia Cooke was brilliant in the sort of smaller role as his girlfriend, and then the great Matthew Almerich turns up at the end in a cameo as well. But yeah, no, it was just a fantastic film and really sort of powerful. And yeah, I think really sort of enhanced by the big screen experience, not only from the sound mix, but I did pick up on a lot more other things as well. So like there was like a little sticker on the fridge in the trailer that they live in, which was like "Meat is murder." And it's like, it's sort of hinted at, it's clear that they've both had their own demons. So he had drug addiction, and then Olivia Cooke's character was certainly sort of self-harming and stuff like that, but they've sort of given all that up. And not only that, but they clearly had gone vegan and stuff as well, which I think I sort of kind of picked up from the song as well, which the song, you know, was a heavy metal song, so it was quite difficult to hear. But actually sometimes, I mean, I don't know if you're like this, but I certainly now have, I think for like ever since I've kind of been in lockdown, actually I've almost sort of had the captioning on Netflix and stuff like that as well, just to get a bit more out of the films, because sometimes, you know, you can miss things due to the sound mix. You know, certainly Christopher Nolan films have been criticized for the sound mixes in the past. Ironically though, Amazon Prime, which has Sound of Metal, is actually pretty bad for so the subtitling and captioning. I think Netflix has actually been very, very good in terms of its sort of dubbing and subtitling and stuff like that. But yeah, no, Amazon, and certainly, I mean, to try and find a film on the Amazon menu, the menu is terrible. But yeah, no, they've got a few bit more work to do on the
subtitles. To be fair, Amazon Prime for subtitles. You know, I lived with someone for a few years that had that issue, and it was just like Netflix, you've always got it. Disney Plus, it's like everything under the sun, it's there. I mean, Amazon, there is really no excuse from them for that type of money. And I really liked as well that the film was subtitled. I would love to have seen like that rolled out with, I think we mentioned with Quiet Place too, but they really need to like up the amount of screenings that they're doing, whether it's the Avengers or James Bond and so on. I mean, people might moan and bitch as they always do at like the beginning, but like you kind of forget the subtitles are there, you just kind of blend into it. It's really not an issue. And if, you know, the couple of people that are going to moan or tweet at Cineworld or whoever about it, there's going to be so many more and other people that will be able to go to the cinema and go, oh, I got that story, I could tell what was going on, I made sense of it. It's a win-win situation as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, because I mean, I'm not sure if I mentioned these facts on last week's podcast, but I was looking at Quiet Place 2 out of curiosity in Aberdeen, and I think there was 163 screenings of Quiet Place 2 programmed in for last week. Two of those had subtitles. They were both at the exact same time, one at each of the Cineworld, so View didn't have any subtitled or captioned screenings. I mean, I guess to throw people a bone, you know, Cineworld did at least program it at about 5:30 on a Monday night, so at least it was after work, whereas normally, you know, you could just imagine them putting it on at like 12 o'clock midday on a Tuesday or something, meaning that hardly anyone could go see it. So, I mean, a lot more does need to be done in the amount of things, especially given, you know, that one of the characters is it just adds to that sort of thing. But I think, you know, there does need to be more work done on this, particularly in sort of screeners and stuff like that. I mean, there's, whenever I get a screener, I'm always looking to see if it's possible to put the captioning on. So when I'm watching it on my laptop, I've got the captioning there. a lot of the screeners that you get do not have that option, which makes it, you know, not very inclusive to, you know, many members of the Film Critics Society who do, like you say, have these sort of hearing impairments and stuff like that. So how can they truly be able to watch and critique a film if they're not able to enjoy it in the way that they can? So, yeah, no, I think more needs to be done, but certainly send a metal call, and kudos to Vertigo Releasing for their rollout of it with that, and hopefully it just becomes the norm. You know, was it Bong Joon-ho said, you know, over a year ago that, you know, people need to get over the 1.5-inch barrier of subtitles. He was obviously talking about, you know, people watching foreign language films, but I think that can be sort of widened out to any film with captioning and or subtitling. You know, the highest grossing film of all time, Avatar, I would say actually about a third of that film is actually in subtitles, with Navi as the Avatar language. In that, it's got foreign language. Inglourious Basterds, obviously, you know, had that amazing scene at the beginning where it is in subtitles, but then Christoph Waltz, you know, asks if they can switch to English because he's exhausted his use of French. That was meant to be a bit of a haha, look at us, you know, he's making a comment about subtitling, but then of course it turns out there was a reason that Christoph Waltz's Nazi wanted to change to English, because obviously the Jewish people under the floorboards couldn't understand him in English, so that was used to his advantage again. So there was always reasons, but you know, I think subtitling has got a place, and it needs to be widened out, because yeah, I think it shouldn't really impact your enjoyment of it. You just don't focus on that lower half of the screen. You know, there's still much to enjoy, but hopefully, you know, this is the start of a movement that we see roll out towards the cinemas and stuff like that. I know that Filmhouse and Belmont are very good about trying to put on caption screenings wherever they can, but again, it's really more of a distributor issue than an exhibitor one. They can only put on subtitle and caption screenings of digital films which come with the audio files for that. Obviously, you know, you would have thought it would have been much easier now with basically 99% of cinemas, you know, fully digital. You know, you can just play the subtitled or caption track on it, you know, whereas before, a 35mm film, you would basically need a 35mm print with the subtitles on it. So therefore, there should be more, it should be easier for people to access these kind of screens. But at the moment, sadly, it does not seem to be.
Yeah, it's sad to hear, but hopefully it's the start of something. You know, change can come slow, and I know that I read a great article last week where it was about with people with disabilities and health conditions. Were like, it's amazing how quickly the industry, whether it's films, music, changed last year to make things accessible for people, and the boost to people with disabilities and health conditions getting access to culture, whether it was streaming gigs, etc., was immense, and it made them feel part of something, made them feel inclusive. And then it's amazing how much of that has been pissed away so quickly with things opening up and been forgotten about. And you know, it doesn't take much money to do some of these things. It can only bring in an audience that will pay to go to these things, to watch these things. And that is you know, an area that is being underrepresented, but are willing to put money into the economy. And you know, if cinemas are to survive, they've got to tap into the people that aren't just going to go see Fast and the Furious and James Bond, etc. You know, it's small changes that can be made to make the whole thing more inclusive and bring more people into the tent.
Absolutely, because I mean, if they are wanting, like you say, if cinemas want people to stop watching films at home and come back to the cinema, they need to give them those options, because at the moment, if it's easier for people to watch subtitle and caption films at their home, then they will, you know, they can watch it at a time that suits them and stuff like that. So they do have to work it out, because I mean, like you say, there was so much, you know, people had to pivot very, very quickly during the pandemic to providing services and stuff like that. And I mean, you just have to look at the news briefings, all these COVID briefings that we get. If you're in Scotland, you get the First Minister with someone in the background doing some British Sign Language behind them. And yet still, you know, 15 months on, if you get a UK one with the Prime Minister doing it, they still don't have someone doing a sign language for deaf people to watch at the same time. It just astounds me that still hasn't been picked up on. But yeah, that's a completely other thing. That's a government thing. We're talking about cinemas. But yeah, you can see the point. But yeah, I mean, the rollout there, and you know, it's sadly to see that, you know, in other ways, the advances that were made in making things more accessible to people are starting to slowly shrink away, as I'm sure you have and many other film critics have started to get those emails that are inviting you to press screenings, which are only taking place in London rather than getting access to a digital screener.
Yep.
Yes.
We'd love to live in Soho, would be nice.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, you could just pop on a four-hour train, head down, watch a screening, and then pop on a four-hour train back. You know, it's easy peasy. They just expect you to be able to do it, don't they?
No, that was my last ever trip to London, was to be able to do the exact same thing. So, yeah, it would seem a fitting way to return.
Absolutely. So, you know, we're going to... I'm going to put a pin in this one for now. You know, we were talking about... started off on a hugely positive note, talking about Shiver Baby and stuff, and I've gone on to a little bit of a rant at the end. But safe to say, Sound of Metal, fantastic. Minari, fantastic. Go out, see these films on the big screen. But let us know what you've been watching at the cinemas. But we'll be back next week with reviews of An Absolute Nobody, in the form of Nobody, starring Bob Odenkirk, who gets his own John Wick film. And then we'll also be reviewing Anthony Hopkins' Oscar-winning turn in The Father. So we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.